Richard Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique. Never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Saturday, everyone. And welcome to Richard Skipper Celebrates. I'm Richard Skipper. I auditioned for the part and I got it. Really, folks, I hope that you're all doing well. I want you to grab your favorite beverage, and I want you to sit back and spend the next hour with me celebrating an incredible gentleman. But before we get to that, I want you all to take a pause for a moment. Today is number 219 since all of Broadway shut down temporarily. Hopefully it'll be back soon. But just imagine if we didn't have the arts in our lives. Imagine if we didn't have the theater. I think that this is a time for all of us to take a collective pause, to take a deep breath together, and celebrate what we had, what we currently have, and what we will have in the future. My hope and my prayer for everyone is that as the theater comes back bigger and brighter and bigger than anything that we've known, that we will have a greater appreciation, not only for what we see on the boards, but all of those people that are working behind the scenes. When the pandemic started, I started doing these interviews. I call them Richard Skipper Celebrates because I'm all about celebrating artists and their body of worth. But I've always appreciated them, but I appreciate them even more now. And that's the sound people and the lighting people and all the people that are behind the scenes that work to bring us entertainment. Because right now I'm on my own, but I'm not alone tonight because I have a very special gentleman that I'm very excited. I am glad that he came into my life recently. His name is Norman Matthews, and he has a book called The Wrong Side of the Room, A Life in Music Theater. And it just so happens that he's here right now. Hello, Norman. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. How are you, Richard?
I'm doing great. It's good to see you. I want to know, how are you really in the midst of this crazy world that we find ourselves in?
Well, it is difficult. Just missing the theater, missing going to movies, missing all of those concerts that I love to go to, the ballet. It's been very hard. And then for my own work, of course, it's pretty much been shut down. So that part of it is difficult. It's been a little less for me than for some people, simply because I had a kind of tragedy just before the pandemic hit. I lost my spouse of 51 years, who was actually my muse as well. So that sort of superseded the problem with the pandemic for me. And this seemed less important than that at the time. But now, as time goes by, of course, this is becoming more of an issue for me.
Well, I am very sorry to hear that. And we'll dedicate the show to your spouse.
Thank you.
That's great. I want to go all the way back. First of all, this book is an incredible book. And the detail with which you write, first of all, you are a playwright, you're a composer, but, author. Have you written other books other than this book?
No, that's the only book I've written so far.
Well, I'm telling you, the details into your life, as I was reading the book, I was talking to someone yesterday about the book, and I said, I could feel the presence of your family growing up in Rockford, Illinois, where it all began for you, and then the rich history that you painted of your grandparents and them coming to this country and everything. It's just a very interesting journey. I grew up in South Carolina, and I grew up on a tobacco farm, and I've written about that and everything. But I always felt, and your book brought a lot of these memories back for myself as well, that I was born at the wrong time, at the wrong place, with the wrong family, with you name it. I felt that I was the outsider. Mm-hmm. And you talk about this in your book.
Exactly.
What is your earliest memory that you had growing up in Illinois where you said, you know, something's a little awry here and I don't belong here?
Probably shortly after my birth, I think. It was everything seemed just a little wrong for me. As wonderful as my family was, and Rockford was not a terrible town, it was just perhaps the wrong town for me. But I think as I started school, I began to realize that I was not like those kids around me. There was something very different about me. Teachers had to take a special interest in me. So right away, I began feeling strange. I right away began very much interested in drama and the movies. And so I threw myself into that stuff. And my own life just didn't seem to fit with what I was seeing on the screen.
A lot of the questions that I'm going to ask you, you know, I've read the book, but a lot of the questions I just want to ask you just to get a through line going through. Let's talk about, first of all, your family life. If you can describe your parents to everyone and what it was like growing up in that home in Rockford, Illinois.
I come from a Sicilian family. And so the name Norman Matthews shouldn't throw you. My real name was Ignatius Norman Congelosi, which got changed when my grandparents immigrated to this country from Congelosi to Cancelos for some reason, which has really no ethnic flavor about it at all. And I kept the name Cancelos as a performer for several years. And then I began to notice that nobody ever remembered my name. They never pronounced it correctly. They started calling me Norman Congrios, Norman Cantaloupes, Norman. And I thought, you know, you're in a business where it really is important for people to remember your name. And so a friend of mine suggested, why don't you take your father's first name, which was Matthew, and make it your last name, which is what I did. Mm-hmm. So my parents, my grandparents immigrated from Sicily at the early part of the 20th century, around 1907. And why did they come to Rockford, Illinois from Sicily? It was just astounding to me to begin with. But what happened was that a brother of my grandmother's had moved to Rockford, Illinois from New York because there was a lot of work in Rockford at the time. It was a major industrial center. And so my grandparents came to New York. Other relatives were here in New York, and they expected to meet those relatives in the city. But when they got here, they didn't show up. And so they kept looking around. Where is Tony? Where is he? Where is that? And they couldn't find this person. So they didn't know what to do. So they just got on the train and went to Rockford, Illinois. And that's
how.
Why not? So that's how they happened there. We had an interesting kind of living situation in that my grandparents ended up buying a 4-family apartment so that right next to the house where they live, so that each of their children could have an apartment. So the whole family lived together in these 4 apartments, and then my grandparents across the driveway in their own home.
So, now, is your family still in Rockford, Illinois? Do you have relatives there at all?
I have some distant cousins, and that's all. Anymore. I haven't been back to Rockford for probably 20 years.
Wow. I know you write about in the book how you had you could not wait to get away from there.
Yeah.
And I pretty much felt the same way about my home state. But I find that as I've gotten older, I really have an appreciation from where I really did come from.
Exactly.
And that's the same feeling that you have as well.
Exactly. And interesting enough, I don't have that negative feeling toward it that I had, I think, when I was younger. And I just have to bring up this one story. There are a lot of people on Broadway from Rockford. They came much later than I did. Joe Mantello was from Rockford. Several people on Broadway. But Joe was interviewed by the New York Times several years ago. And somebody asked him, how was it that you grew up in a small town, Rockford, Illinois, and then you ended up going to the North Carolina School of the Arts, and now you've become a big Broadway star? How, you know, what was that like for you? And he said, it was a little bit like having been brought up by apes and then discovering civilization.
You don't feel that way, do you?
I would never have said that. So, no, I don't have that negative feeling toward it any longer.
And tell everyone a little bit about your parents and your earliest memories and your fondest memories of both your mom and your dad.
Okay. My father was a superintendent in a toy manufacturing company, and I actually ended up working there a couple of summers in high school. My mother was had wanted to be a fashion designer, but didn't seem to have the ego or the drive to go to Chicago and put herself through the school. So she ended up being a sales clerk in a department store. Both of them very religious people, very kind, not involved in the arts at all. Nobody in my family that I know of really had any musical ability. Distant cousins, I think, did, but no one in my immediate family. So I was the only one. I began singing off the radio when I was 2 or 3 years old and entertaining people. And I never was sure what caused this, but they must have made me self-conscious, because by the age of 5 or 6, I refused to do that anymore for anybody. And
you know where that refusal came from? Was it just an obstinance as a 5-year-old?
I don't know. I honestly have a feeling somebody made an issue of it, perhaps, and I don't recall that, which is strange because I have an extremely good memory. I think I mentioned it in the book that I have very strong memories from the time I was 2 years old. We lived with my grandparents for the first 2 years of my life, and I can recall sitting in a high chair demanding that I have cafe latte in the morning at 2 years of age.
You also say, I mean, you talk about, I know that you're also a gourmand, you're a cook as well, but yeah. You also mentioned in the book that you absolutely abhor breakfast.
Yes, I don't know. I never eat breakfast. I never have. But I wanted that coffee. And strangely enough, as an adult, I don't drink coffee anymore. But because my grandfather was drinking it, he would drink it in a large bowl and put pieces of Italian bread in it and dip it. And that's what I had to have in the morning at age 2. So as I said, I can remember those incidents. Why I don't remember stop singing, I don't know. I can't explain.
And do you think that really set the trajectory for the way that you've lived your entire life? That if there's something that you want, that you go after it, you don't think about any of the other circumstances surrounding that?
I'm not sure that that's the case. I was not a self-assured child. And I think that was part of the problem. So any kind of, if I'd had a criticism or somebody made fun of me or whatever it might have been, I don't know. But that in itself would cause a problem for me, and I would shut down and not do it from that point on.
And was there music and arts in your home, you know, growing up as well?
My grandfather loved the opera. I mean, really loved it. I did not find myself attracted to the opera. He tried to get me interested in it, but he would listen to the Metropolitan Opera broadcast every Saturday and try to get me to sit and listen to it. I was not able to have that attention span to be able to follow it. I loved the music. I loved the sound of it, but I just didn't really get into it at that time. My parents loved to hear music, popular music only. And that was the extent of arts in our home. I never saw professional theater until I was a senior in high school.
And when was the first time that you actually stepped foot on stage as an actor?
Probably in eighth grade. I was given a part in a play as Tom Sawyer in a play called Huckleberry Finn Detective. I don't know who wrote it. I can't find anything about it. But that was my first time, and my dramatics teacher there thought that I should go to acting school. And so she put that into my head at the time. And she said, you've got to start thinking about it right now. And the two schools that I want you to consider are the Goodman School in Chicago and the Pasadena Playhouse. So by the time I was a sophomore in high school, I'd already written to them and I was thinking about applying it. That was my goal in life. But I noticed that every time I mentioned it to people, I got very negative responses. So I stopped mentioning it altogether. And then I decided, well, I'll tell them that I wanted to be a director instead, maybe, because I didn't really know what a director did at that point. And I knew that they didn't know what a director did. So I thought that would take the edge off of it. So that was what I, how I had passed through that period of my life. Again, because of my lack of self-confidence, I didn't do well in theater in high school. For some reason, I was cast in The Boyfriend, but only in the chorus. And I was so discouraged by that, that I decided I really couldn't go into theater and I couldn't go into acting. And I was a very good student, always from the very beginning. And all of my teachers, when they would hear about my theatrical ambitions, would say, you can't waste your life like that. You've got a brain. You've got to go to college. You've got to do this. So I finally just capitulated to it. And I remember my parents saying to me, well, we'll send you to acting school, but we don't have the money to pay for you to go through school, for you to come out a bum. And I thought, is that what I'm going to become, as a bum?
Take us back to that time. I mean, people who may be watching tonight may not realize, and maybe some people still do, but that was the perception of all actors, no matter what your level of success was. Exactly. The people in the theater were bums.
Yeah. And that was it. And so the discouragement from that and my own lack of self-confidence, I guess it was, I decided, well, I couldn't do this and I had to go to school. So at the last minute, I had to brush up on math and things that I hadn't taken because I had no plans to go to a regular college. I was going to these schools and I didn't need to have math and science and all of these things. So there was a last minute rush to get that all done. And then I went off to Denver University and with no idea what I should do. So I thought, well, I'll major in business. I mean, what else can I do? I can't do anything. So I majored in business and I realized right away that this was not for me. This was a really bad choice. So I decided I would switch to psychology. I'd taken a couple of courses in psych and I thought was doing very well on them. And I liked analyzing myself, so I thought this is a very good career for me. I got into it, and I realized I liked it, but did I like it enough to get a PhD in this? I don't think so. And a friend of mine asked me to take a dance course at Denver University, where I was. And the woman who gave that dance course was an ex-Hanya Holm dancer. And as it turned out, I was one of the best people in the class. I had not
had a lot of dance experience prior to that, or was it just something that came natural to you?
I was always dancing around the house, always. My mother, when I was four, and this is in my book, took me to a dance class, thinking that, well, he's always dancing around the house, he should learn how to dance. So I went to this dance class and it was this strangest kind of operation I've ever seen. The woman had us running around the room in circles with our arms extended, pretending that we were airplanes. And I was one of those children who never really was a child. I was born an adult. I felt from the very beginning. I didn't relate to other children. I related only to adults. Me. And for me to run around this room like some maniac just was so horrifying to me.
Book, and it reminds me of a story. Nathan Lane tells this great story that he spent $300 on an acting class shortly after coming into New York City to pursue a career as an actor. And they all had to act out something they saw out the window. So when he went and looked out the window, the acting teacher said, "So, Nathan, what do you see?" And he said, "I see $300 flying out the window." Because there are those people who think that, you know, if you're going to dance around, you know, like an airplane, that you're getting the training that you need. And that's not it.
So anyway, I went up to my mother right after, and I told her very quickly that we were leaving this class immediately and I was not coming back. She assumed because of that, that I hated dancing and that I would never want to dance. And so she then instead, the kindergarten teacher that I had said, "Your son is extremely musical. You should give him some kind of musical lessons." And a cousin of mine who lived downstairs from us had a piano, and I was always picking out melodies on the piano. So my mother started me on piano lessons, and that's what happened. So I had about 10 years of lessons with which I was not serious at all. I really didn't practice. I had a strange kind of attitude towards the arts, I think, as a kid. I didn't somehow understand that in order to be good in the arts, you actually had to work at it. I thought that if you were good in these things, you were just naturally good. And I wasn't that naturally good at it. So I didn't really work at it because I didn't think I had any ability toward it. And I had teachers who were giving me the kind of music that didn't interest me at all. But my parents had spent all this money on it, and they kept going, and I felt very guilty about not giving it up. In the meantime, my brother started tap dancing lessons, and he wasn't good at that at all. But I used to take him to the tap lessons, and I'd watch, and I would tapping away. I was, you know, like, I can do that. We brought a chorus line. I was that kid, except I didn't have the nerve to tell my mother I wanted to quit piano and take tap dancing lessons because I knew she had spent all this money. And she had this thing about, you didn't switch from one thing to another, because if you did that, you never ended up anywhere. You had to take something and stick with it. And so I was afraid to tell her that I really wanted to quit piano and take tap dancing lessons. I gave little hints. I had a pair of penny loafers. I took them to a shoemaker and had taps put on, and I would tap around the house thinking that she might get the hint. And she would say, you know,
and the downstairs neighbors loved it.
my downstairs neighbor loved it. So that was how I got, I didn't get any dance training as a kid until I went into college. But the minute I took this class, she said, "You really need to study. You really should study." And so at that point, I decided, you know, if I'm going to study, I really want to be in New York anyway. I always wanted to be in New York. So I left Denver, came to New York City. I had to convince my parents that I was coming to, I went to New York University. I had to convince them that I was going to continue college here. I figured what I would do is I would go to school like a good little boy, get my psychology degree from NYU. And in the evenings when I was free, I would take my dance classes. But then I found it was so expensive to live in New York, and it cost so much money to take dance classes. I just didn't have the time or the money to do either. So I
take everybody back to that time and what it was like when you first came to New York and your early days in New York. First of all, your parents, the reaction when you said, "I'm going to go to New York to see if I can make a go of this." Take us back to that moment.
They didn't fight me much because I didn't mention theater. I convinced them that New York University was a much better school for psychology than Denver University. And of course it wasn't true. And I knew that they wouldn't know one way or the other. I wasn't going to tell them about dance. I was going to keep that as my own little thing while I satisfied their requirements. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have a problem over that. But we did have a problem the minute I decided to drop out of school at the end of that first year at NYU so that I could study dance. And I told them I'd get a job And I would do that. And I remember my mother said to me, you have 1 week to get a job. If you don't get a job, you're coming home because we're not supporting you to do this at all. So that's what I had to do. So I first got a job as a Fred Astaire dance instructor. I took a course. They gave a free course on becoming a Fred Astaire dance instructor. And of course, I thought this is so perfect for me. I would teach
at that time. Well, there were Fred Astaire studios all over the country.
Oh yeah. So on Lexington Avenue and 51st Street, there was a studio. I passed through the exams. You had to learn all these dance figures. And I began supposedly teaching. What I didn't realize was that you didn't just go there and teach. You had to develop a whole clientele of students. And in order to do that, it seemed almost as if you had to be a gigolo, because I remember I had a 7-year-old woman that I had to escort for a weekend. I had to take her to the Latin Quarter, and then I had to take her dancing to the Roosevelt Hotel. And then she started making overtures to me. And I thought, I don't think I was cut out for this. This is really not, you know, you're really a salesman.
Well, that's your business, folks.
So I decided I needed to quit. And when I quit, that was when my mother told me that I had a week to get another job. And the funny, this is one of the funny areas of finding a work. I didn't know what I could do because I really had no skills. I'm a college dropout. I have no skills whatsoever. What am I going to do? So I looked in the New York Times and I went to an agency, and I was a scared little kid. I'm not even 20 years old. And I walked into the agency and I went in at 10 o'clock in the morning. I've never been a morning person. And the man looked at me and he said, you're looking for a job? I said, yes, I am. He said, then where the hell were you at 9 o'clock this morning if you're looking for a job? I said, I'm just getting here now. It's 10 o'clock. Well, what can you do? I said, I don't know. I've been to college. What did you study? Psychology. Psychology? What good is that to you? He said, do you have any business experience? I said, well, I did take a couple of accounting courses. That won't do it. No, I don't think you can do anything. So I was really discouraged. I went back to the New York Times, and there was an ad that said, department store announcer. Now, I didn't know what a department store announcer was, but I thought, oh, there's a sale on lingerie on the 5th floor. I could do that. That's all. I mean, make the announcement. I thought that's what it was. So I went to this agency that had this job, and the man said to me, have you ever been a department store announcer? I said, no, I never have. He said, tell me what a department store announcer does. I said, I really don't know. He said, you know, I don't think this is the job for you. Can you type? I said, yeah, I can type. Let me hear you type. So he sent me over to this old rickety typewriter, and I started typing away like crazy. I was a very good typist. Anybody who studied the piano can type usually very easily. He didn't look at what I typed. He didn't say a word of it. He just said, he heard me. You're great. What is it you want to do in life? I said, I'm going to try to study to be a dancer. I've got the perfect job for you. There's a job opening at Dance Magazine. He said, I'll bet you've worked on your high school paper. I said, no, I never did. No, he said, well, you like writing, I bet, don't you? I said, no, actually, I don't. I don't like writing at all. I know you're interested in this. And, you know, the guy is trying to get me a job, and I'm doing everything I can to discourage him, because I didn't want to present myself as knowing something I couldn't. He said, well, I'm going to send you over for this editorial assistant job at Dance Magazine. So I went over there, and they took a liking to me right away, and I was hired. And so editorial assistant jobs mostly entail typing. That's what it is, some proofreading, things like that. So that's all I was doing. But within 2 or 3 months, my boss said to me, you know, you're too bright to just sit here and type. I think you should try editing. I have no idea about it. He said, you just take one of these columns and edit it. You know what our style is now. So I did it, and he said, I'll give you maybe a B minus on that. This is what you should have done. This is what you should have done. This is what you should have done. And so little by little, I began editing. He went away on a vacation to Puerto Rico, and I got a call at 5 o'clock in the morning from the publisher of the magazine saying, get into the office right this minute. I said, it's 5 o'clock in the morning. And she said, your boss just died in Puerto Rico.
Oh, my God.
Your boss just died. There's nobody who knows what's happening. This was in the news section of Dance Magazine. Nobody knows what's happening in the news section but you. Get in here. You're going to have to do that. I'm 21 years old at this point. I've never had an experience. Oh, my God, how am I going to do that? She said, oh, we'll help you. I got in. Nobody helped me. I was responsible for 24 pages of the magazine.
Wow.
Somehow I was able to get that done. And 2 or 3 months later, they were happy with it. So they made me a news editor. I had just replaced a man in his 50s to be news editor of Dance Magazine. And I was Clive Barnes' editor at 21.
Well, I want to talk about some of the career highlights, throughout your career. Otherwise, we're going to run out of time when we get there.
Yeah.
But with all of this going on, when did you start auditioning and how did you get your first professional gig?
Okay. Right away, when I got the job at Dance Magazine, I began taking 2 ballet classes at night, every night. I was very dedicated about it. And so I was able to progress very quickly, even though I was starting really serious dance study at 21. That's very late to begin dancing. And people were very discouraging about it. You can't possibly dance starting at this age. You're too old already. But I just wouldn't listen to them. I decided I was going to go ahead with this. So I kept doing it. And I studied for almost 3 years. And then I decided I would start auditioning. I can remember the very first audition that I went to was for a television show called Hullabaloo. And I had not studied any jazz or anything. I'd only studied ballet. And they started giving all of this stuff, and I had no idea what I was doing. And the people they hired for that were Michael Bennett and Donna McKechnie. They weren't people like me. And it was very discouraging. I thought, can I really do this? Am I never going to be able to do this? But I just kept doing it and doing it. And finally, by that end of that summer, I was hired by Pittsburgh Civic Light Opera. And that was my first professional dance engagement. So I did 7 shows in Pittsburgh. And I learned a lot. In fact, I was so far behind where everybody was that I had never partnered a girl. And so when I got the job hired, I thought, what if I have to do a lift? I don't even know how to do that. So I quickly took one lesson with a person, a ballet master, and just trying to learn basic partnering techniques. And you don't learn that in one lesson, but somehow I had to learn it. So I took that lesson and I went to Pittsburgh, and I did quite well. But it was the hardest dance job that I had in my whole career, because the choreographer, the initial choreographer, was an old ballet, Russian ballet master, and most of the chorus was the Chicago Opera Ballet at the time. Now, these were kids who had been, doing ballet since they were 6 and 7 years old, and they were very advanced, and there I was with my 2 or 3 years of training, no jazz background, nothing. And so I had to learn in a hurry. And of course, when you do repertory stock, you're doing one show in the at night and learning another show in the daytime. You learn very quickly.
A lot of work.
Yeah, it's very hard. So that was my first introduction.
Well, there are career highlights that I want to focus on.
Okay.
And again, on the scroll at the bottom of the screen, the name of the book, and everyone can go out and get the book. It's available on Amazon, and there is the link there to order that. I hope that you'll all go out and get the book. But there are a few highlights that I want to touch on before we do lose time tonight. And what brought us together, of course, is my coverage of Hello Dolly over the years. And you've got two incredible stories that we want to share. One having to do with the film version of Dolly. So stick around for that. Great story. And you also did the national tour with Dorothy L'Amour. Mm-hmm. So how did you, did you just go to a general open call? Did you know someone in the company? How did that come about?
I did just go to a general open call, and Vernon Lusby, who was the dance captain of the Broadway company at the time and was one of Agnes DeMille's assistants, gave the audition, and I was hired at that time by him. And that was, it was strictly an open call.
But there's a great story that you tell in the book about how high you actually jumped in the air during the waiter's gallop.
Yes. For those of you who haven't seen the show, at the end of the waiter's gallop, all of the waiters holding trays or skewers or whatever they have bend and nearly touch the ground and then jump and then touch the ground again and jump. So there's a series of about 24 jumps. And it's difficult, but not terribly difficult. We had an incident with Dorothy Moore. She wanted very much to play some of the army bases because she had been used to doing that sort of thing during the war. So we played Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. When we got there, there was not actually a stage. It looked to me like it was plywood set on top of sawhorses. And so that's what we had to work with. Almost no sets, nothing. And during the waiter's gallop, I was the first one out, so I did all of the jumps in that. And I noticed right away that I was beginning to fly. I wasn't just jumping, I was really soaring into the air. And the reason for this was that the plywood was acting as a kind of trampoline for us. And so as each dancer came and added to the thing, we started getting higher and higher. And of course, this was very difficult with the music because you weren't able to time the music too well because we didn't know just how high we would be going and how long it would take us to descend. So we were literally flying by the time all of the waiters came out and were doing their jumps. It was a very wonderful experience. Can I tell a bit about Dorothy? And
I would love that. Absolutely.
Yeah. During the whole first act, all of these soldiers out there were sitting somber-faced. There was virtually no applause, no laughter, no response to anything that we were doing. And we couldn't understand what was happening because we always got tremendous response all of the time. So during the intermission, the commandant of that Ford came back to speak to Dorothy, and she said to him, "What's going on out there? Do they hate us so much? There's no response. Nothing is happening." He said, "No, I told them that they had to behave themselves. They were not to make any noise, to make any sounds. They had to be very, very calm and to watch the show, you know, with respect." And she said, "You go out there and you tell those boys to have a good time because we're dying up there on the stage and this is really tough." So he did that. He made an announcement to them. And the second act was like chaos out there. I mean, they were applauding and screaming and yelling. And it was as if we were doing two different shows. It was an amazing kind of thing.
That's a great story that I love in the book that I want everyone to buy the book to read about. In how she dealt with a certain critic that was not too kind to her. So all of our actors and actresses out there read to see what she does. The next career highlight that I want to talk about was somewhat of a misstep, if you will forgive my saying so. And that was, of course, working on the film version of Hello, Dolly! With Barbara Streisand and Walter Matthau. Mm-hmm. So if you could share that experience with everyone.
I only did two numbers in that. Most of the movie was shot in Hollywood and had already been shot by the time that I got back from tour for Dolly. I'd only been back, I think, about a month or two from the tour. And a friend of mine called and said they're auditioning for dancers because they're shooting two numbers upstate New York, one in Garrison, which was the Sunday Close number, and then the finale they were shooting at the very point at West Point. He said, let's go and audition. I was cooking dinner for people. I said, I can't. And I just couldn't do it. He said, no, just drop what you're doing and go. So we both went. We both got the job. And the very next morning, we were on the set. It was the most amazing thing in the world because we had to appear at Grand Central Station at 5 o'clock every morning. And there was an entire train called the Dolly Express that brought, I think it was 24 dancers that they hired in New York, and 3,000 extras. And we were all put on the train at 5 o'clock in the morning and brought up to Garrison, New York, to film these two numbers. And it was an incredible experience because it was so hot up there at the time. The costumes were so heavy. I was wearing a wool suit that felt like it was about 4 inches thick. And it was one of the hottest summers that we had had.
Right.
So it was very, very difficult with that. Shall I tell the business about the costume?
Yes.
Or should I say that?
No, I would like you to share that story.
Okay. So because we were only in these two numbers, they were not, and this was, we were mostly there to fill the screen, basically, because they had brought all the Hollywood dancers with them, and they were doing the major part of the work. They were not about to design new costumes for us. They had all of the old wardrobe from 20th Century Fox that they brought with them in case they needed it. And that's what we had. So when it came to doing the finale, which was shot at the point at West Point, and I should tell you that they actually, by helicopter, dropped in an entire New England church at the point, at the very point of West Point. And
it's so funny because that particular spot, so many people to this day go to that spot looking for that church that doesn't.
Yes, and it's not there. Yeah. It was just a facade, of course. Now, there are 3,000 people in this scene. I was assigned a partner.
Everyone, this is the finale.
The finale, yes.
Scene.
I was assigned a partner, and I was in a very good position right in front of the church, right where Barbara Streisand would be coming through, because it's her wedding scene. We're shooting the scene, and I'm dancing back and forth, and all of a sudden, I hear from the top of the hill, which is a good distance away from where we're shooting, I hear, stop this movie. Stop this movie immediately. And I thought, what on earth is going on? I saw this woman wildly running from the top of the hill. And she's coming. And I realized she's coming to me. I thought, what on earth have I done that I could possibly have done to do? And what it was is, My partner had a dress that the label inside said had been worn by Judy Garland in the Harvey Girls movie. It was the ugliest dress I have ever seen in my life. It was this turquoise crepe material that was covered in brown chenille balls all over. It was hideous. And of course, we had no choice about what we were wearing. They just assigned us these costumes. But the woman screaming down the path was Irene Sheriff, the costume designer. She saw from practically a mile away this costume, I guess through a telescope or something or other, came screaming down right to us, and she said, "Get that costume out of my movie. Get that out right now. I will not have that costume in my movie." So my partner and I were sent to what was outer Siberia, basically, as far as the set was, not to be seen anywhere.
Wow. Well, one other, I want to talk about your work as a composer and a writer. You wrote a one-person musical about Dorothy Parker called You Might As Well Live, which our dear friend Karen Mason starred in. What was it about Dorothy Parker's life that inspired you to create an entire musical built around her?
Actually, it wasn't her life at all. When I began composer, it was my spouse, Todd, who convinced me that I should start composing. I had never composed in my life, but he virtually pushed me into it. And when I began starting, I didn't know where to begin. Actually, I had never studied composition, although I have a master's degree in music theory, so I have a very good background in it. But he convinced me to start this, and so I wrote to Stephen Sondheim and asked him what I should do, who I should study with. And Stephen suggested that he didn't know anyone that I could study musical theater writing. He said, "You really need to study with a classical composer that you admire and write that kind of music. And from that, you will learn how to write Broadway stuff." So that's what I began doing. And I had been writing a lot of classical music up until that point. But because my whole life had really been in the musical theater, I thought I should do something with that. I didn't know where to begin. I thought, well, nice jazzy tunes could be set to Dorothy Parker poetry. So I started setting a few of her poems to that. And I got a much of them set thinking that it would be a cabaret piece. As it turned out, I couldn't seem to get anyone really interested in it as a cabaret piece. So I decided maybe if I turned it into a one-person show, that would be the way to go. And I didn't know where to begin writing a play. I'd never written a play before in my life. I tried to find people who would be interested. No one was interested. I did all this research on her life and then began incorporating the music that I had written into this biography over. I mean, I did enough research that I could have written a biography on her. I spent hours and hours in the library researching this. And it went through a lot of processes. Both Michelle Pauk, who won the Tony Award, and Karen Mason were the two people, major people that I've had perform that musical, both of whom were wonderful, both of them in very different ways, but very wonderful.
We talked earlier about Dolly. Let's talk about Michelle and Karen.
Okay.
Two very different actors, singers. They each had their own style. What was it that each brought to the role that made it uniquely their own?
I would say that for Michelle, she has a certain darkness about her. She has what somebody called a world weariness, which fit Dorothy Parker very well. And so people think of Dorothy Parker as just a jokester. But of course she wasn't. She was a very sad woman. Her politics fit very nicely into today's. I've written some articles on her political stances, and I noticed that those articles are getting so much response on the internet right now just because she was so highly against racism and against oppression and all of those sorts of things. So that was the serious side, and Michelle was very much into that kind of thing. Karen, with both of them with wonderful voices, Karen was very good at bringing the funny side of, they were both good at the funny side, but Karen's specialty was more on that side. She's not a dark performer as Michelle contended to be. So I would say that would be the two major differences in their performances.
And how long did it take you to actually write the musical, and what was the process to get it on the boards?
It probably took me a little over a year. That's to get a first draft, because I was not a playwright. I had no idea how to do it. What actually I did, I put together what I thought would be a play, thinking then I will take it to a real playwright and they will turn it into something. But that never happened. I never found the right person to do that. And I just kept working on it until I had actually 32 drafts done of that thing. So that evolved over several years.
Did it open in Chicago?
It was done here with Michelle many times as a staged reading. York Theater did it for me once with Michelle, and the readings, they used to sell out their readings to their subscriber audience, and it was sold out immediately because of Michelle and because of Dorothy Parker. So that was where it got its start. And then I was asked to be part of Stages 2003 in Chicago. And they specifically wanted Karen Mason to do it because she was a Chicago personality. So that was when Karen really got involved, although Karen had initially done the demo for me of the show. So it got done there, and then it got done at the Chicago Humanities Festival. It was done at the Harris Theater in Chicago, which is a huge new opera house there. My poor little one-person show, so small on this big stage. I felt so bad. But it was a 2,000-seat theater, mm-hmm. Not the right venue for it. And then from there, it was the Orlando Shakespeare Theater. Picked it up. And so it was done there in a series of new plays that were presented. They weren't really big into musicals, so mine was one of the few musicals that was done there at that time.
Now, I want to say there are so many layers to this onion in your book. With everything that you've done, and first of all, The Wrong Side of the Room, how did you come up with the title?
The Wrong Side of the Room had to do with an audition that I went to. I was in a particularly bad shape after my first season in Pittsburgh. I came back to New York. I was broke. I had been living with somebody who decided that he wanted to end the relationship, threw me out of the apartment. I had no money, no place to live. I desperately needed a job. There was an audition at Lincoln Center for the opera Julius Caesar. And it was a big ballet audition. I went and I got the job. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, wow, Pittsburgh, and now already I'm at Lincoln Center. I'm dancing in a ballet, company. It was so exciting. They asked us on our birthday to come in for a costume fitting, on my birthday, to come in for a costume fitting. I remember it was a Saturday. I went in thinking, I've got this job. I had gotten unemployment, so I was unemployment to that point, but they only gave me unemployment because I told them that I had this job coming up. I had been working as an editor up until that point, and I had only 9 weeks of dance performance at Pittsburgh. And so that didn't qualify for me for unemployment. So they put me on a kind of trial basis. If you get this contract, you can get unemployment until the point that you get into rehearsal. Fine. I went in to have my costume fitting, and the choreographer said, would those of you on this side of the room, please step to the right. And those of you on this side of the room, please step to the left. I happen to be in the middle of the room. Should I go right? Should I go left? I thought, well, I'm a little closer to left. I'll go left. I went left. And he then made the announcement, I'm sorry, but our budget has been cut in half. Those people who are on the left side of the room, thank you very much. I can't use you. And so I lost not only the job, But I also lost the unemployment. And I thought, happy birthday, Norman. You know, this was great days. Norman,
what's the gift in that? Do you know what the gift is?
No. What is
title for a book? And you.
Yes.
And that show business. I mean, we are actually at the end of our show, and I can't believe it because there's so much to talk about. There are so many levels that we haven't even touched about in terms of your private life, and you are so open with things that have happened in your life that took a lot of bravery to put on these pages and to share with the world. And I really appreciate the fact that you have written this book. I want to thank everybody who has joined us this evening. And if you enjoyed the show, and if you haven't done so already, please go to my website, which is richardskipper.com, and sign my guest book with your thoughts about the show, because this helps to boost me in other markets. I also tell everyone at the end of every show to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. So tonight, what I would like you all to do is to go to your friends list on Facebook. I know, Norman, that you're not on Facebook, but go to your friends list on Facebook and go to the eighth friend and order this book and send it to them. Get a copy for yourself as well, because we want this book to get out there among all these other people. Norman, again, I want to thank you. You came into my life. You just took a chance by reaching out to me, having read some of my Call on Dolly articles. And I appreciate the fact that you did make that effort. And it's really, you know, the through line throughout your entire book with taking chances. And to me, that's the ultimate lesson that comes out of this book. That you always took these chances, and that you didn't think maybe you were that kid from Rockford, Illinois, who didn't belong there. And you moved beyond that. And then, you know, if the piano lessons didn't work, maybe tap lessons. And if that didn't work, maybe I'll type. Maybe I'll get a job as an editor for Dance Magazine. All these things happen because you were open to them. Mm-hmm. Now, before we leave tonight, I want to give you the last word. Anything you want to say to anyone who's listening tonight about the times that we're living in, your philosophy on life, your mission statement, any message that you want to give to everyone watching, you have the last word. And again, I thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thank you. What I would say is, I think what I learned most was the fact that people tried to discourage me from doing so many things. They didn't want me to be an actor. They didn't want me to be a dancer because I was too old. Then they didn't want me to be a pianist because I was too old. Then I couldn't be a composer because I was too old. And so what I would say to people is, if you want to do something, do it. Find out for yourself. Put yourself out there and see for yourself, because I've always regretted that I didn't make that acting plunge to begin with. Maybe I wouldn't have been an actor, but I would have discovered dance. I would have discovered musical theater. I would have discovered so many things. So go out there and do it if that's what you want to do, especially if you believe that you have some talent or some need for it.
Thank you, Norman. You're the best.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.